Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Kate Young. For today's show, we reach into the archives for some stories with Earth Eats founding host and producer Annie Corrigan. She takes us to the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice in Terre Haute, Indiana, for some adventures in dairy. From Harvest Public Media, a story of Benedictine nuns raising livestock. And former Earth Eats student reporter Haley Grossman looks at one farmer's journey towards organic certification. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. Let's get started with a year-end news wrap-up. Chad Bouchard pulled together some of the big stories in food policy from 2017. Joining us at the news desk today is Alex Chambers, new to the Earth Eats team as associate producer. Welcome aboard, Alex.
Thanks, Kate. It's good to be here.
Ready for our year-end wrap-up of food policy news?
Sure thing. I've been waiting for this all year. And the nominees are... Food policy watchers were on high alert in early 2017 as the curtain rose on President Donald Trump's White House. The year kicked off with delays and controversy over nominations for the key posts in the agriculture and labor departments. Trump chose Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue to lead the USDA. After his confirmation hearing was delayed for several weeks, Perdue finally took the helm in March. Perdue sells fertilizer and has a big financial stake in the agriculture industry, and was accused of breaking ethics laws in Georgia during his tenure in office. So far, he's scrapped Obama-era rules to help protect livestock and poultry growers, and rolled back school lunch rules meant to improve childhood nutrition. Under Perdue, the department is operating with only half its Senate-confirmed positions currently filled. In July, Trump nominated non-scientist Sam Clovis for head of science at the USDA. Clovis served as one of Trump's campaign aides and was an outspoken denier of climate science. Clovis withdrew his nomination in late October due to his entanglement with Trump campaign attempts to forge a relationship with Russian officials. Trump's appointment for commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, Scott Gottlieb, also raised objections due to his close ties to the drug companies that he is in charge of regulating.
And now for the year in labels. This year saw a push from trade groups, including the Grocery Manufacturers Association, to update expiration labels. With little oversight from the federal government on expiration label standards, companies have developed a wide variety of sell-by and best-if-opened-by language of their own, often arbitrarily applied. Trade groups say the inconsistency confuses shoppers. The new label guidelines are voluntary. A bill requiring labels for genetically modified ingredients was signed into law in 2016, but the USDA has yet to hammer out what products would qualify and how the labels should look. Final rules are supposed to be in place by July of 2018. Meanwhile, the FDA delayed the deadline for companies to comply with new rules on nutrition facts labels that will include larger calorie counts, more accurate serving sizes, and the amount of added sugars. That deadline was set for July 26 next year, with smaller companies getting an extra year. A new deadline has not been set, but industry groups asked the Trump administration for an extension to 2021. And speaking of delays, new rules were set to take effect earlier this year requiring food service chains to include a calorie count next to each item on their menus. Most of the chains had already implemented the new guidelines in anticipation of the deadline, but the Trump administration delayed the implementation of the new law. It now appears to be set to take effect in May of 2018. And that's a sampling of some of the stories we covered in the world of food news in 2017. Thanks to Chad Bouchard for rounding those up for us. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
My pleasure, Kate.
There's more from that year-end wrap-up on our website, eartheats.org. And next, we go to a 2014 story from Earth Eats founding host and producer, Annie Corrigan.
It's a holiday, and you've likely got a little more free time now than normal. So let's get creative in the kitchen. Homemade dairy products. I signed up for the basic dairy making workshop at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice in St. Mary of the Woods, Indiana, a few months ago.
This is good, old-fashioned, old-school dairy product making.
That was Robin Morton, our dairy guru for the day. She's also the associate director of the White Violet Center. She passed out a huge packet of recipes, but almost immediately she then encouraged us to put them away and just watch.
These are products that have been made for thousands and thousands and thousands of years by people who may not have gotten as far as living in a covered structure, These are useful instructions. I encourage you to follow them as closely as you can, but don't freak out about them.
In preparation for the class, she did a lot of shopping for milks and creams of all sorts. She ran into a snag along the way.
And I defy you to find cream that is not ultra-pasteurized. I probably killed 20 minutes in the grocery store trying to find any cream product that wasn't ultra-pasteurized, and I could not do it.
That won't matter for our first recipe, but it will matter later on in the show. Anyway, she made 6 or 7 dairy products over 3 hours. It was amazing. We're highlighting 3 of them today. First off, butter, maybe as easy as it gets. It's not a cultured product. That means it doesn't have to sit and incubate. It also only requires 1 ingredient, that cream. Here's Robin.
There are 3 basic methods you can use to make butter in a home kitchen. It depends on how much you want to clean up, honestly. So one very easy method, is if you have some kindergartners running around that you want to keep occupied. Everybody had to do this at some point in elementary school. You got the mason jar, and you shake and you shake and you shake and you shake, and you wonder why your teacher hates you, and you just keep shaking, but eventually you get butter out of that deal. That does work. That's fine. You can use a stand mixer if you would like. The problem with using a stand mixer is at some point, very quickly, butter is going to separate out from water, and you're going to be spinning that really fast, and you are going to have to clean up every single horizontal surface in your kitchen if you are not on top of that situation. This is why I am an advocate for the food processor. This is by far, I think, the easiest method, because you put it in here, you have a lid on it, you press on. Okay. So you guys know this is going to hit sort of a whipped cream stage first. All right, so this is now starting to look like when your mother-in-law comes in the kitchen and says, "You've over-whipped it." Okay, so you've gone a little too far for whipped cream, but that's okay, because that's where we're headed. Well, at some point, you're going to start to hear it actually change, because you're going to start hearing a slosh, basically. So you know what? You got to keep going. Now it really changed. Now you can actually hear it sloshing and... And now, we have butter. So now here's the trick. If you want this to keep for any amount of time, what you need to do is you need to do what's called washing. And I'm actually gonna show you how to do that, because it's really easy in here. So what you do, you add coldest water you can reasonably get, maybe just a few ice cubes. This is forcing out more and more of that extra water, so I'm gonna pour this off. So you have to clean up a couple of horizontal surfaces with this.
Just a little sloppy toward the end there. So that's butter, really simple. Another easy cheese recipe with Robin Morton in a couple minutes. The nuns that live in the Abbey of St. Walburga spend their days praying and thinking about life's biggest questions. Some of them also raise cattle. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon visited the small community of Benedictine nuns, where raising livestock is the livelihood.
About 5 miles south of the Colorado-Wyoming border, a large stone sign on a 2-lane highway points visitors to the abbey. Down a short driveway into the stony valley, idyllic red farm buildings sit in the shadow of the main abbey, where 22 sisters live, pray, and work.
Good morning! Oh, that's so
3 nuns step out of a retro Ford truck, dressed in simple white veils. Oh, and jeans, plaid shirts, and Carhartt jackets.
Hi, nice to meet you, Luke.
Sister Walburga runs the abbey's ranch. Other sisters give her a hand. And the list of agricultural activities here is long. They raise cows, llamas, chickens, and bees. The most unique addition? Water buffalo, milked to make mozzarella. But the biggest moneymaker on the farm comes from the beef cattle. The money from sales goes to supporting the abbey. Sister Walburga says the sisters are very aware of their marketing edge.
We have a bit of a corner in the market, you know, nuns selling natural beef. You know, people kind of believe in it, you know.
They've been in the grass-fed beef game now for about 7 years. And because their ranch is so novel, they've never had a problem selling the meat.
Some of our customers want it because of the beef. Some of them want it because they know how they're being cared for. We didn't have much trouble, and now we just always have a waiting list for the beef.
To keep the baby cows safe from the region's numerous predators, like bears, coyotes, mountain lions, the nuns employ an unorthodox set of security guards.
The llamas do have a purpose besides, baby calf protection. We have actually seen them chase a mountain lion off the property.
What?
Yeah. That's why we have llamas have various weaponry. One of them is their breath. they kill with their front feet. You know, they try to disembowel you. If they were upset with you.
That's right. A disemboweling guard llama raised by nuns.
Go ahead and call him.
All the cows are gonna come, sister.
Is Daisy taking the lead?
When many religious orders were founded centuries ago, agriculture was more than a way of life. It was a way of survival. You raised the food you ate. And while farming has become less common as we've urbanized as a society, Sister Walburga says the Abbey's farm is more than just a quaint business. While other sisters have questioned the ranch's value, she says it keeps the sisters connected to the outside world.
You know, when our neighbors are suffering from drought or suffering from flooding, we can totally relate to them. Like, you know, we're not, you know, above and beyond. And, you know, the nuns are never touched by weather issues. Or, you know, it's good to be at the mercy of the environment. And so other people know, you know, that we don't live some kind of ethereal life.
Most Benedictine monasteries use the motto Ora et Labora, meaning prayer and work. That motto doesn't represent separate ideas to the sisters. All day, prayer and work are intertwined.
Praying with the scriptures is like chewing your cud, that all through the day, we're ruminating on it. So we chew, 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 swallow, regurgitate, chew, chew, chew. So it's not just the Lord is my shepherd, it's the Lord is my cowboy.
With farm work done for the morning, it's time for prayer. Back down at the main abbey, Sister Walburga is in her traditional black and white habit. After prayers and a quick lunch, the sisters will be back in their Carhartt jackets to round up some rogue llamas. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
More stories about food, fuel, and field from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, which is harvestpublicmedia.org.
Are you guys familiar with paneer? Some of me? This is the blandest cheese in the existence of cheese.
But don't be fooled. Robin loves paneer, and she also loves how easy it is to make. Back in the teaching kitchen with Robin Morton at the White Violet Center. Just like butter, this is not a cultured product, but it does require some acid. She likes to use lemon juice. She says it's tasty. Unlike most dairy recipes, she is purposely boiling her gallon of milk to force out the proteins. The acid then forms big, lumpy curds that you'll press into a block that can then be sliced.
A bit more sort of stick together. So you got the clearish whey, greenish yellow. I know it looks funny, but that's right. And then you've got the curds themselves, and the curds are sinking down. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna get myself some nice big piece of cheesecloth. Huge piece. The bigger the cheesecloth, the better. Trust me. There is no worse feeling than gathering up the sides of the cheesecloth and lifting it up and realizing that it was narrow here, and then it all just pours. Oh, you're just like, really? Pour this in. You want to mess with this when it's still pretty darn hot, because while it's hot, you can get it to stick together better. So I've got a rubber band right here, conveniently on my wrist. So I'm going to take this rubber band. I am going to try to get this as tight as I reasonably can without actually breaking or ripping the cloth. Now, press that and let it cool and press, and those curds are going to come together and form a solid block that hopefully I can cut.
Use a cast iron pot to press the curds. After an hour or so, you should be good to go. Pair this with Daniel Orr's amazing sog recipe, which is an Indian dish made from spinach. That recipe is at eartheats.org. He's getting into the cheesy spirit in the second half of the show. A nice goat cheese appetizer for us. Then the infrastructure at New Ground Farm is in flux. Mike Record says that's purposeful.
We're trying to be pretty minimal and also portable or changeable. As we learn what works best, we want to be able to change things around.
He's also starting the process of becoming USDA certified organic. More from him coming up.
Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com.
Earth Eats. Hi there. I'm Annie Corrigan.
My Christmas memories, always there's a cheese ball. Always at every right? Christmas, every memory I have is a cheese ball.
And a lot of times they're really bad.
Horrible. They're wrapped in plastic, covered in miscellaneous nuts. Awful.
And sometimes they're even gritty. And they have this kind of fake port wine poured on top of them. And very odd. Well, we're going to make one that's going to change your mind about cheese balls. All right. So I've got about a pound of good goat cheese. This is from Caporeal Farms. I'm going to make this a little bit sweet and a little bit savory, you know. So we have some dried cherries. You could use cranberries. We're going to rough chop some pecans. And we're also going to throw some bacon in this.
Of course.
We're going to cut these into little pieces. All right. Now we're just going to mix this up. And again, you can use your hands. One of the best tools in the kitchen.
It's like a softball of goat cheese right now.
So we got that, and now what we can do is we can decorate it and take some rosemary leaves and just kind of press them into the outside, a little bit of thyme. I think that the rosemary really gives it that kind of Christmas tree look and flavor. Okay, and I'll just get a little plate, and there you have it. That's a nice local goat cheese ball with bacon and dried cherries.
The recipe is at eartheats.org. Whether an organic farm is new or old, every farm has one question in common. Should my farm be USDA certified organic? Is it worth it? Student reporter Haley Grossman brings us the story of Southern Indiana's New Ground Farm as it starts the journey to certification.
Every American kid knows the song Old MacDonald.
A one, a two, a one, two, three. Old MacDonald's had a farm, E-I-E-I-O.
These are my friend's little siblings. Bobby is 6 and Zach is 9.
Do you think Old MacDonald had an organic farm?
Probably not.
Farmer Mike Record has probably taught his kids that same song. Mike and his wife Elizabeth own and operate New Ground Farm in Bloomington. The farm is 22 acres, which Mike says is shaped like a banana. We're standing in his barn, and the wind is swirling. He's in the process of renovating it in the hopes of eventually having animals in here.
Well, the first thing you see that's probably the most noticeable is the big red barn.
Record considers this barn a marketing tool. It is right off the road.
We're going to try to capitalize on that by being able to sell vegetables from the farm here. Hopefully the red barn will be a distinguishing feature, landmark.
Everything about Mike's farm is about being a successful businessman.
Everything is thoughtful and serves a larger purpose. The first step was naming the farm Newground Farm.
Because, for several reasons. I guess the most obvious one is that it's new ground for us. I don't think vegetables have ever been produced here, so it's new in that sense. But also because we're really interested in what to us seems like kind of a new way of doing agriculture, which is smaller and more intensive, with direct connections to the customers, the people that eat the food.
When you look around the field, there's not a lot of infrastructure. Mike is using trial and error before he makes anything permanent.
We're trying to be pretty minimal and also portable or changeable. As we learn what works best, we want to be able to change things around and not have something that we installed in a permanent way that we can't change. So for example, the blue pipe you see lying here, this is how we got water out to the field. It's like a fire hose, but it runs from near the barn to all the way at the end, and it enabled us to get water out to irrigate, but we can roll it up and move it if we decide this isn't the best place for it.
Besides naming the farm, they had another choice. Become certified? It was a mixed decision.
Primarily, the general consensus in the field seems to be that it's not really worth it for small operations. So, you know, maybe we're kind of going against the grain a little bit.
I visited Mike several times for 4 weeks, and every time I came back, he had made a new change to the farm. With all these new elements, Mike thought it was a good time to start the organic certification process. He grew organically in Colorado, where he was certified naturally grown. This is a state-sanctioned organic label for farmers. The thing that appeals to him most about organic agriculture is its emphasis on being good to the soil, growing healthy soil.
The way you treat the soil first, ensure that it's healthy, and then from there that kind of moves towards products that come from the soil that are healthy, whether it's produce or meat. And then from there, I think that obviously leads to healthy people and I think healthy communities.
Organic farming isn't just about growing healthy soil. There's a lot of red tape. Record is working on building an organic system plan, which is a lot of record keeping.
It describes how we produce our products, and then we have an inspector come who looks at the farm and basically verifies that what we've got in our plan is in fact what we're doing. And then once that's done, then the certifier, which is a third party entity, will either approve or deny the application.
I asked Mike through all of this hard work why he's doing this.
I guess for us, what it has served to do is to really force us to think about how we want to farm and our processes, and then get that written down on paper.
If you believe in the old children's song, like I did, you'd think being a farmer was all fun and games, E-I-E-I-O. But what I learned from Mike Record is really it's paperwork here, crop rotation there, here's some soil, there's some fertilizer, veggies everywhere. And maybe, thanks for farmers like Mike Record, the next generation of kids will know Old MacDonald as an organic farmer. For Earth Eats, I'm Haley Grossman.
This story is a collaboration with Earth Eats and the Indiana University School of Journalism. With a quack quack here, a quack quack there, quack there, quack everywhere, quack quack, chick chick here, chick chick there, chick there, chick everywhere, chick chick. Old MacDonald had a farm. We watched Robin Morton make a couple really simple dairy products in the first half of the show. Now it's time for dairy making grad school, so to speak, mozzarella. This is the culmination of the class at the White Violet Center.
The mozzarella we're going to make in here, I'm going to struggle with it for a while because I'm really going to be having to force this to work.
All right, so here we go. Our first landing point is 55 degrees. That's when she adds the citric acid. Next, it's 88 degrees, and then she adds the rennet that helps curdle the milk.
I'm going to turn it up a little bit.
Add the calcium chloride, then...
My benchmark, what works, what has always worked, is to wait, and you're going to start seeing it. It's going to start to form up, and it's actually going to form into a curd, and it's going to start pulling away from the sides, and you're going to get a gap around the edge of the pan.
We see that, so now it's into a microwave-safe bowl. Nuke it to separate even more whey, drain that whey off, and repeat. Be careful, though, it's hot.
Okay, as you may have realized, this is not quite mozzarella yet. Now, trying to press it together a little bit.
She's using now a slotted metal spoon to mash the curds into themselves.
Oh, man. This is vaguely working.
Not really.
I'm going to feel really bad if I can't make mozzarella for you guys.
She tried again from the very beginning, and it still didn't work. Robin was clearly annoyed.
I called her up several days later to see if she was able to troubleshoot what went wrong.
White Violet Center, this is Robin.
Hey, Robin, this is Annie. Come to find out, she made mozzarella at home no problem a couple days later. She even posted a video of the process online. She made the video for a couple reasons.
One of them was to finally allay my mind that I wasn't going crazy, that this would work. And I wanted to let people know and show them it wasn't the technique. The technique is doable. You just have to get the right product.
So what was the culprit? The milk, just as she'd expected.
I got a different brand of milk. I got, you know, just from a different store in a different dairy. And they must have used a more gentle pasteurization technique of some kind. Either they didn't hold it as long or they didn't heat it as high, something like that. And those proteins weren't as badly damaged. And so when I did the exact same process with the new milk, the curd was actually able to hold together so that the whey would come off, and then you could keep getting the whey off and off, and that's how you end up with that curd that you can stretch for a million miles.
But how can you tell when you're buying milk? Because you had the Kroger milk, and it didn't say, this milk is super pasteurized.
You can't. That is one of the incredible frustrations of, in fact, the more I teach this class, the more and more frustrating teaching this class gets.
Because she's just not sure what she's going to get with these store-bought products. So, what milks will always work? Farm-fresh, unpasteurized milks. But many states have laws forbidding the purchase of raw milk. So, she also suggests befriending a dairy company and asking them about their pasteurization techniques. Other than that, it's just trial and error. But when you do get it right, mozzarella is so fun to make. The video shows her pulling the cheese a good 3 feet into the air. It looks like taffy.
What I love about making mozzarella in that class is it's this sort of big payoff at the end of the class. It is the most awesome thing when everybody sees that both, it really is easy, and it is so cool.
Robin Morton, Associate Director of the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice at St. Mary of the Woods. I'll post her mozzarella video on Twitter so you can follow it and make your own cheese at home. Connect with us at Earth Eats.
That was the voice of Annie Corrigan, founding producer and host of Earth Eats. We've got a link to the video Annie mentions. You can find it, eartheats.org. Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers on Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Thanks to everyone on the Earth Eats team, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Annie Corrigan. Our executive producer is John Bailey. This is Kate Young signing off, and we'll see you next week for our final show of 2017.